And I, as you pointed out, I really couldn't have asked for a better introduction for this big data session. We are here to talk about the goddamn I.O. So now the session is about about big data, but I'd like you to just take a flight of fancy with me for a second. Just imagine an alternate universe where what really was important was the little data. I have a feeling that most of us probably would have stopped making headlines a long time ago in that case. And the reason for that is because I think, at least from a systems perspective, little data really is a solved problem. We already have the perfect little data computer, and it's right there on page one above the fold. It's a single machine that has a bunch of processors and a bunch of disks, and they're all tightly coupled together with something like a RAID controller. And for I/O intensive workloads, this computer really is ideal. Let me tell you why I love it. First, when applications write, the RAID controller splits up those writes pretty finely and stripes them over all the disks. You might have a small number of writers writing a lot, or a large number of writers writing a little bit, or even a combination of both at the same time in the same cluster. But the lulls in one writer are filled in with the bursts of another one, meaning we get really good statistical multiplexing of the disks. All the disks stay busy, and high utilization means we're really extracting all the performance that we can from all the hardware that we've paid for. The story with reading is similar. They can also exploit those striped writes. We get full performance out of the disks again. Even if some processors are consuming data slowly and others are consuming it quickly, all the disks stay busy, which is really what we want. And it's really easy to write software for this computer, too. It doesn't matter how many physical disks there are. As far as programmers are concerned, there's just one big one that you can pretend you have. And files written by any process can be read by any other process without caring at all about locality. And finally, if we're trying to attack a large problem in parallel, for example, if we're trying to parse a giant log file, the input doesn't need to be partitioned in advance. All the workers are draining a global pool of work, and when it's exhausted, they all finish at about the same time. This prevents stragglers. It means that the job finishes sooner. And we call this dynamic work allocation. This is something, of course, that has been around for a long time, but I think it's been lost in some of the modern generation of big data computing. So another really nice benefit of the small data computer is that it's really easy to adjust the ratio of processors to disks just by adding more of whichever one you need. You can fit the resources of the machine to match whatever the expected workload is of the cluster. Okay, so what's the problem? Well, back in the real world of big data, the problem is if this machine doesn't scale. We can add a few processors, maybe a few dozen processors or a few dozen disks, but we can't add thousands. Well, why not? Let's take a look at that thing in the middle there, because that's really where the magic is happening. And roughly speaking, it's doing two things. The first is metadata management. When a process writes, that thing decides how the write should be striped, and it keeps enough state around that later reads can find the data that was written. And second, it's responsible for physically routing the data from disks to processors, actually moving the bits themselves. So with FDS, we've built a blob storage system that fully distributes both of these tasks, which means that we can build a cluster that has the essential properties of the ideal machine that I described for little data, but can potentially scale up to the size of a data center. And in the next 20 minutes, I'll describe how. So here's the 90-second overview. FDS is a simple, scalable blob storage system. Compute and storage are logically separate, and there's no affinity, which means that any processor can access any data in the system uniformly. That's why we call it flat. We've combined that conceptual simplicity with a very high I/O performance that you've come to expect really only from systems that couple compute and storage together, like Dryad, MapReduce, or Hadoop. FDS has a novel way of distributing metadata. In fact, in the common case, read and write paths don't go through any centralized components at all. We get the bandwidth we need from a full bisection bandwidth class network using novel techniques to schedule traffic. So with FDS, we've demonstrated very high read and write performance. In a single replicated cluster, a process that's just in a tight read or write loop can achieve more than 2 gigabytes per second all the way out to remote disk platters. And to give you a sense of scale, that means we're writing to remote disks faster than many systems can write locally to a RAID array. Disks can also speak to each other at high speed, which means that FDS can recover from failed disks very, very quickly. For example, in one test that I'll be talking about later, in a 1,000-disk cluster, we killed a machine that had 7 disks that were holding about 2/3 of a terabyte of data total, and FDS brought all the lost data back to full replication in 34 seconds. And finally, we've shown that FDS can also make applications very fast. We described several applications in the paper from a few different domains, but in this talk, I'm just going to be talking about one, which is that we wrote a straightforward sort application that sits on top of the FDS blob store, which beat the 2012 world record for disk-to-disk sorting. And our general purpose remote blob store beat previous records that all exploited local disks. This summary is also going to serve as an outline of my talk, which I will now give again, but a little more slowly. So let's get started and talk about the architecture in general. So first, let me tell you what FDS looks like from the point of view of applications. In FDS, all blobs are identified with a simple GUID, and each blob contains zero or more allocation units that we call tracts, which are numbered sequentially starting from zero. All tracts in the system are the same size, and most of our clusters, a tract is 8 megabytes, and I'll tell you a little later why we picked that number. A tract is the basic unit of reading or writing in FDS. The interface is pretty simple. It has only about a dozen calls, such as create blob and read tract and write tract and whatnot, and it's designed to be asynchronous, meaning that the functions don't block, but instead you give them a callback, and the callback gets called when they're done. So a typical high-throughput FDS application will issue a few dozen reads and writes at a time, and then issue more as previous ones complete. And we call applications that use this FDS API the clients, at least for this talk. So in addition to clients, there are two other types of actors in FDS. The first is what we call a tract server. And the tract server is a simple piece of software that just sits between a raw disk and the network, accepting commands from the network, such as read tract and write tract. And there's also a special node called the metadata server, which coordinates the cluster and helps readers rendezvous with writers, or sorry, which helps clients rendezvous with tract servers. So as we saw in the previous slide, the existence of tract servers and the metadata server, and for that matter, the network as a whole, is invisible to programmers. The API just talks about blobs and track numbers, but underneath, our client library is contacting the metadata server as necessary, and it sends read and write messages over the network to the tract servers on behalf of the client. So an important question, of course, is how does the client know which tract server should be used to read or write a tract? And this brings me to the next part of my talk, which is metadata management. So to understand how FDS handles metadata, it's useful to consider the spectrum of other solutions that exist in current systems. So on one extreme, we have sort of the more centralized system. So this is exemplified by things like GFS and Hadoop that really manage metadata centrally. And on basically every read or write, clients consult a metadata server that has canonical information about where all the data in the system lives. And this gives you really good visibility and control, but it's also a centralized bottleneck that has exerted pressure on these systems to increase the size of writes. For example, GFS uses 64 megabyte extents, which is almost an order of magnitude larger than FDS. And this really makes it harder to do fine-grained load balancing across disks like the ideal little data computer that you saw at the beginning. So then on the other end, we have distributed hash tables. Now, they're fully decentralized, which means there's no bottleneck, but reads and writes typically require multiple trips over the network before they actually find the data. And failure recovery is also relatively slow because it's a localized operation among nearby neighbors on the ring. So with FDS, we tried to find a spot sort of in between these two extremes that gives us some of the best properties of both. We want one-hop access to data. We want really fast failure recovery that involves basically the entire cluster. But we don't want the centralized bottlenecks and common case paths that we get from a centralized metadata server. So now FDS does have a centralized metadata server, but its role is very limited. When a client first starts, the metadata server sends some state to the client, and for now just think of that state as an oracle. When a client wants to read or write a tract, the underlying FDS library has two pieces of information. It has that blob's GUID, and it has the tract number that it's trying to read or write. So what the client library does is it feeds those two pieces of data into the oracle, and it gets out the addresses of the tract servers that are responsible for replicas of that tract. In a system with more than one replica, reads go to one replica, just selected at random, and writes go to all replicas. The oracle's mapping of tracts to tract servers really needs two important properties for the system to work the way we want it to. The first, of course, is that this mapping has to be consistent. A client reading a tract, of course, needs to go to the same tract server that the writer got when it was writing the tract. And second, this mapping has to be pseudo-random, because as I mentioned earlier, clients have a lot of reads and writes outstanding simultaneously, and that parallelism is a lot of what gives us our performance. And so this oracle needs to ensure that all the operations are going to different tract servers in the system. We don't want all the requests going to just one tract server if we have 10 of them. So once the client has this oracle, reads and writes all can happen now without contacting the metadata server again. Since reads and writes don't generate any metadata server traffic, This really lets us do a very large number of small reads and writes that all go to different spindles, even in a very large scale system. And that gives us really good statistical multiplexing of the disks, just like the little data computer did. Also, we really have the flexibility to make the writes as small as we need to. So for throughput-sensitive applications, we use these 8-megabyte tracks that I mentioned earlier. And that's because at 8 megabytes, we've sort of amortized the cost of a seek away. And so even reading and writing randomly is about the same speed as sequentially. But we've also done experiments with seek-bound workloads, where we push the track size all the way down to 64K. And that's very hard to do with a centralized metadata server, but no problem with this magical oracle. So by now, you're probably wondering what this oracle is. What it is a table of all the disks in the system, which is collected and distributed centrally by the metadata server. We call this table the tracked locator table. So it has as many columns as you have replicas. And in this example, we see 3 columns, so that means it's a triple replicated system. And in a single replicated system, the number of rows grows linearly with the number of disks in the system. In multiply replicated systems, it grows as n squared, and we'll see why a little bit later. Okay, so how does a client use this table? It's actually pretty simple. It takes the blob GUID and the track number that it had before, and it runs them through a deterministic function that yields a row index. Then we just look up that row index in the table and find the track servers listed there. As long as readers and writers are using consistent versions of the table, then the mappings they get will also be consistent. And in the paper, we describe how we do consistent table versioning, but I won't talk about it here. So something, again, very important to note about this table is that it only contains information about disks. It doesn't contain information about the individual tracks. In other words, reads and writes don't change the table. So to a first approximation, a client can just retrieve this information from the metadata server once and then never contact the metadata server again. The only time the table changes is when a disk fails or is added. So there's something else clever that we can do with this track locator table, and that's distribute the per blob metadata. In other words, things like a blob's length and permission bits and whatnot. So we store this in a special tract that we just label as tract -1. And clients can find that metadata tract the same way they find any other data tract, which is just by plugging -1 into that tract locator formula. This means that the metadata is spread pseudo-randomly across all the track servers in the system, just like the regular data is. Track servers also have support for consistent and atomic metadata updates. For example, let's say several writers are trying to append to the same blob. In FDS, they each execute an FDS function in the API, which is called extendBlob. And this is a request for a range of track numbers that can be written without conflict from other writers. The track server serializes the requests and then returns a unique range to each client. And this is how FDS supports atomic append. In systems with more than one replica, the requests go to the track server in the first column of that track locator table, and then that server does a two-phase commit to the other track servers before returning a result to the client. Now, something else that's nice here is that because we're using the track locator table to determine which track server owns each blob's metadata, different blobs will most likely have their metadata operations served by different track servers. So the metadata, the metadata traffic and the load of doing the serialization is also spread across every track server in the system. However, requests that need to be serialized by virtue of the fact that they refer to the same blob will always end up at the same track server, which is what maintains correctness. Okay, now that we've talked about how FDS handles metadata, let's talk about networking. Up until now, I've just assumed that there was an uncongested path from track servers to clients. Now let me describe how we actually build such a network. So first, just a little bit of background, which is that until recently, the standard way to build data centers was with significant oversubscription, meaning that a top of rack switch might have, let's say, 40 gigabits of bandwidth going down to the servers in the rack, but only 2 or 4 gigabits going up to the network core from the rack. In other words, the link to the core from a rack was oversubscribed by a factor of, let's say, 10 or 20. And of course, this is done to save money. But in the last few years, there's been an explosion of research in the networking community in what is called a class network. Now, this is actually a very old idea which has been revived recently. And a class network does more or less for networks what RAID did for disks, which is that you can connect up a large number of low-cost commodity switches and add some clever routing. And what you get is that it's now economical, really for the first time, to build a full bisection bandwidth network at the scale of an entire data center. So in FDS, we take this idea one step further. And that's because even with a class network, many computers in today's data centers still have a bottleneck, and that's the bottleneck between disks and the network. A typical disk can read at about a gigabit per second, but a typical server will have 4 or 12 or even 25 disks in the machine, and they're all stuck behind that one single gigabit link. And for applications that have to move data, such as a big distributed join or a sort, this is a big problem. So in FDS, we make sure that all machines that have disks have as much network bandwidth as they have disk bandwidth. For example, a machine with 10 disks needs a 10 gigabit NIC or 10 1 gigabit NICs as it did in our early versions of our system. And a machine with 20 disks needs 20 gigabits of network bandwidth coming into it. Now, of course, adding all of this bandwidth has a cost. Depending on the size of the network, because it's not quite linear, maybe about 30% more money per machine. But as we'll see a little bit later, we get a lot more than 30% performance as a return on that investment. So we actually built this thing. This is actually about a third of one of our clusters. We've gone through several generations of test beds. The largest has about 250 machines and about 1,500 disks. And they're all connected using 14 top-of-rack switches, each of which has 64 ports and 8 spine switches, giving us a total of about 4.5 terabits of bisection bandwidth. And as you can see, we made a company that sells these 10G network cables very happy. Unfortunately, just adding all this bandwidth doesn't automatically give you good performance as we thought it would when we were young and innocent at the beginning of this project. So part of the problem is that in realistic conditions, data center class networks don't actually guarantee you full bisection bandwidth network. They only make it stochastically likely. And this is an artifact of routing algorithms that select a single persistent path for each TCP flow to prevent packet reordering. As a result, class networks have a well-known problem handling long, fat flows. Now, part of the reason we designed the data layout algorithm the way we did, as you saw in the previous slides, was because of the network load that it generates. FDS generates a very large number of short-lived flows to a wide set of random destinations, which is the ideal case for load balancing in a class network. There's a second problem, though, which is that even a perfect class network doesn't eliminate congestion. What it does is it pushes the congestion out to the edges. So you still have to do good traffic shaping and really think about bandwidth management. Now, what's really nasty and what sort of caught us by surprise is that these two constraints are actually in tension. Class networks need nice short flows for load balancing, but TCP needs nice long flows for its bandwidth allocation to find an equilibrium. And so this is really where we spent a lot of our time. We ended up doing our own application layer bandwidth allocation using a scheme which is a variant of RTS-CTS, and it's described in the paper, but I won't describe it here. The paper also describes a bunch of other networking tricks. So now let me show you some micro-benchmarks from one of our test clusters. In these experiments, we had clients that were either reading from or writing to a fixed number of track servers. What we did in these experiments was we varied the number of clients and then measured their aggregate read or write bandwidth. And in all these experiments you're about to see, the clients had a single 10 gigabit Ethernet connection. And track servers, or server machines that were running track servers, had either one or two 10 gigabit network connections, depending on how many disks were in the server. So the first result I'll show you is from a single replicated cluster. And note the x-axis here is logarithmic. And I have the distinct pleasure of showing you a graph that is delightfully uninteresting, because the aggregate read and write bandwidth simply just go up close to linearly with the number of clients. And we tested from 1 to 170 clients. Read bandwidth was going up at about 950 megabytes per second per client. And write bandwidth goes up by about 1,150 megabytes per second per client. And reading typically is slower than writing because the incast, or I should say the receiving a large number of competing flows on an incoming interface, is more difficult to do than just sending information out on an interface that doesn't, in which there's no collisions. So in this case, writers saturated about 90% of their theoretical network bandwidth, and readers saturated about 74%. This graph actually shows two families of curves, two different cluster configurations. One used about 1,000 disks, and the other used about half that. And in the 1,000 disk test, the larger test, there was just as much disk bandwidth as there was client bandwidth. The two are balanced. So performance just kept going up and up and up as we added more clients. In the smaller test, the 500 disk test, there was much more client bandwidth available than there was disk bandwidth. And in this case, disks were the bottleneck, so what you see is that aggregate bandwidth kept going up until we had saturated the disks, and then it got flat. It's not shown on this graph, but we also tested clients that had 20 gigabits of network bandwidth instead of 10. And their clients were able to read and write over the network at 2 gigabytes per second, all the way out to remote disk platters. And so again, this is faster than a lot of systems can write to local RAID. And so really the point to bring home from this is that decoupling storage and computation does not have to mean giving up I/O performance. So this second test is similar to the previous one. except we're now writing to a triple replicated cluster instead of a single replicated cluster. And read bandwidth, as you'd expect, is about the same. But also, as you'd expect, writes saturate the disk much sooner because we're writing everything three times. So the aggregate write bandwidth is about one-third of the read bandwidth in all cases. All right, I'd like to switch gears a little bit now and talk about something different, which is failure recovery. So first I'll describe how it works in FDS, and then I'll give you some more performance numbers. So the way that you organize data in a blob store really has a dramatic effect on recovery performance, is the first point to note here. So the simplest method of replication, unfortunately, also ends up being the slowest. What you could do is just organize disk into pairs or triples that are always kept identical whenever anything gets written. And then when a disk fails, you just bring in a hot spare and use any of the replicas that are still alive to make an exact copy of the disk that died. Unfortunately, this is really slow because it's constrained by the speed of that single hot spare disk. And filling a 1 terabyte disk takes at least several hours, which is really too slow. The main problem is it's too slow because recovery actually decreases durability, or I should say a long and extended recovery time of several hours decreases durability because it lengthens the window of vulnerability to additional failures. We want to keep that window in which an additional failure could cause data loss to be as short as possible. And in FDS, we can do better. We can actually significantly contract that recovery time. Because our goal in FDS, when a disk dies, is not to reconstruct an exact copy of the disk that died, but just to make sure that somewhere in the system, extra copies of the data that were lost get made somewhere. We just want to get back to that state when there are three copies of everything somewhere. So failure recovery also exploits the same fine-grained blob striping that gives us good statistical multiplexing of the disk for reads and writes. What we do is lay out data so that when a single disk dies, there is not just a single other disk in the system that contains backup copies of the lost data. Instead, all n of the disks that are still alive each contain about 1/n of the data that was lost. Then what happens is that every disk can send a copy of its small part of the lost data to some other disk that has free space. And since we have full bisection bandwidth in the network, all of these transfers can happen in parallel, which is what makes recovery go so quickly. In fact, since every disk is participating in the recovery, FDS actually ends up with another really nice property, which is that as the cluster gets larger, recovery actually goes faster. And this, I think, is sort of amazing because it's the opposite of something like RAID, where larger volumes typically require longer recovery times. So it's actually pretty easy to implement this scheme using the track locator table. What we do is construct this table specially so that every possible pair of disks appears in a row of the table. This is why, by the way, in replicated clusters, the number of rows in the table grows as n squared. And we can add more columns as long as we want to for additional durability, but to get the fastest recovery speed, we actually never need more than n squared rows. So when a disk dies, such as disk A in this example, the metadata server first selects a random disk to replace every failed disk, or every place that the failed disk appeared in that table. Then it selects one of the remaining good disks in each row to transfer the lost data to the replacement disk. It sends a message to each disk to start the transfer, and since, of course, we're on this full bisection bandwidth network, all the transfers can happen in parallel. So I'm leaving out a lot of the details, but they're described in the paper. Instead, let me show you the exciting thing, which is the results. So we tested failure recovery in a number of different configurations with clusters of both 100 and 1,000 disks, and we killed both individual disks and an entire machine that would contain multiple disks. And let me just highlight a couple of the more interesting parts of the results. So one is in our largest test, we used a 1,000-disk cluster, and we killed a machine that had 7 data disks in it, which is holding a total of about 2/3 of a terabyte of data, and all the data that was lost was re-replicated in 34 seconds. But what was more interesting, at least to me, was that every time we made the cluster larger and did this test, we got about another 40 megabytes per second per disk of aggregate recovery speed. Now, that's about half the speed of a disk, but remember, that's because every disk is simultaneously reading the data that it's sending and also writing to its free space that some other disk in the cluster is filling. Extrapolating these numbers out, we estimate that if we lost a 1 terabyte disk, which is a realistic disk size, out of a 3,000 disk cluster, then we'd recover all of the data in less than 20 seconds. And remember, that's not recovering to memory, that's recovering all the way back to stable storage, all the way back to some other disk platter. And I think what's really sort of magical about these numbers is they really ended up being strikingly linear. Recovery time, of course, is a combination of some fixed time to detect a failure, followed by a variable time to transfer the amount of data that was lost. And in our experiments, of course, the fixed time never really changes, but the variable part increased linearly every time that we added more data to be recovered. So it increased linearly with the amount of data recovered. And conversely, it decreased linearly with the number of disks that were participating in the recovery. I think getting linear results in a system that was at this scale was really cool. Okay, so finally, I'd like to discuss one application of FDS. And as I mentioned, we have several applications in the paper from a few different domains. But I'm just going to highlight one, which is that we set the 2012 world record for disk-to-disk sorting using a small FDS application. So Minutesort, if you haven't heard of it, is a test that was devised about 25 years ago by a group led by the late Jim Gray. And the question is, given 60 seconds, how much randomly distributed data can you shuffle into sorted order? And because this was meant as an I/O test, the rules actually specify that the data must start and end on disk. And we competed in two different divisions. One was for general purpose systems, and one was for special purpose built systems that are allowed to use dirty tricks and basically exploit the specifics of the benchmark. So in the general purpose division, the previous record, which actually stood for about 3 years, was set by Yahoo using a large Hadoop cluster. And by large, I mean about 1,400 machines and about 5,600 disks. So with FDS, using less than 1/5 of the computers and disks, we nearly tripled the amount of data that was sorted, which multiplies out to a pretty remarkable 15x improvement in disk efficiency. And this all came from the fact that Yahoo's cluster, like most Hadoop-style clusters that are built today, had serious oversubscription in two places, both from the disk to the network and also from a rack up to the network core. So we attacked that bottleneck by investing on average 30% more money per machine for more bandwidth, as you've seen earlier, and then we harnessed all that bandwidth by using everything else that you heard in the talk. And the result is that instead of a cluster having mostly idle disks, we built a cluster where the disks were working continuously and, in fact, were the bottleneck resource for the sort. So there's also this specially optimized class, and the record last year was set by UCSD's fantastic Triton sort. You might have read their paper. And they wrote a really nice, tightly integrated and optimized sort application that did a beautiful job of just squeezing every bit of efficiency they could out of all the hardware that they could. And they also used local storage, so they did beat us on CPU efficiently by a margin, a fairly large margin actually, but not on disk efficiency. In terms of disk efficiency, we're actually almost exactly the same. In absolute terms, we set that record by about 8%. Now, what I think actually really distinguishes our sort, though, was that it really was, and I can totally honestly say, just a small app sitting on top of FDS. FDS is a general purpose blob store, and it had absolutely no sort-specific optimizations in it at all. Really, the strongest assumption that we made was just that there would be applications sitting on top of it doing very long sequential reads and writes. And sort had no special calls that it made into FDS. It just used the same plain old read and write blob, read and write tract calls that everything else did. In fact, that meant we had to transport the data three times. Oops. We had to transport the data three times, reading once from disks over the network to the clients, then transporting it a second time over the network as the clients exchanged with each other, and then finally a third time when clients were writing back to track servers. But despite doing all this, we set both records anyway. So I want to take a minute now and also show you the effect of dynamic work allocation. At the beginning of the talk, I mentioned that one advantage of ignoring locality constraints, like in the little data computer, is that all the workers can draw work from a global pool, which prevents stragglers. Now, early versions of our sort did not use dynamic work allocation. We just divided the input file evenly among all the nodes. And as you can see in this time diagram, stragglers were a really big problem. Each line represents one stage of the sort in this graph. And a horizontal line would mean that all nodes had finished that stage at exactly the same time, which would be ideal. But as you can see, the red stage is pretty far from ideal. About half the nodes would finish the stage in about 25 seconds, and then a bunch more would straggle along for another 30 seconds, including some really bad stragglers at the end. And this was bad because there was a global barrier between the red stage and the green stage. Now, we knew it wasn't a problem with the hardware. For example, we knew that it wasn't a misbehaving computer because different nodes were coming in last each time. And after doing a whole bunch of analysis and logging, we concluded it was actually just that it was a big distributed system. There was a lot of randomness in it, and a few nodes would always just get unlucky and lose. So finally, we switched to dynamic work allocation, and these two tests were actually done on the same day with just the dynamic work allocation feature added and no other changes. And in the version on the right, each node would process a tiny part of the input, and when it was almost done, it would go to a head sort node that was coordinating the sort, and it would ask it for more work. And this is all done at the application layer, the sort layer. FDS didn't know anything about this. And as you can see, it dramatically reduced the effect of stragglers, which also then ended up making the entire job faster. It was a really nice self-clocking scheme, because a worker that finished early would get lots more work assigned, would end up doing more overall work, whereas the unlucky nodes would not get more work assigned. They'd end up doing less work total. And this is all really entirely enabled by the fact that FDS uses a global store. Clients can read and write any part of the input they want, so changing, shuffling the assignments around at the last second really had no cost. And yes, I admit it, this is digital socialism. So let me conclude now and say that FDS gives you the agility and the conceptual simplicity of a global store, but without the usual performance penalty. We can write to remote storage just as fast as other systems can write to local storage, but we're able to throw away the locality constraints, which makes the computer much easier to use and also more efficient. We can build clusters that are extremely high utilization. You just buy as many disks as you need I/O bandwidth, or as many seeks per second as you need. Then you buy as many CPUs as you need processing power, or as much memory as you need. And you can put them all together into one cluster. Individual applications can also use the resources in whatever ratio they need. Now, of course, we do have to invest more money in the network, as we discussed earlier. But in exchange, we're really unlocking the potential of all the other hardware that we've paid for, both because we've opened the network bottleneck and because the fact that it is a global store means that we're doing global statistical multiplexing. So now, I just want to conclude by saying that today, a lot of people have this mindset that certain kinds of really high bandwidth applications just have to fit into a rack if they're going to go fast. And that has really constrained the kind of applications that people think about, because racks really aren't that big. So I would argue that we've shown a path around that constraint. And the bottom line with FDS is really not just that it makes today's applications fast, but that it also lets us imagine really genuinely new kinds of applications for the future. Thank you.
Jeff Kenning, Harvey Mudd College. Early on, you said that when you're extending metadata, your particular example was extending a file, the metadata server had to contact the replicas before it answered to the client. I was wondering, isn't that a bottleneck?
Oh, no. The track servers basically serve as a distributed metadata server for that operation. In other words, whichever track server maps to tracked negative one using the track locator table is what serializes operations for that blob. And so the thing that we were calling the metadata server, that centralized metadata server, is not involved at all. It's never contacted.
All right, I was wondering about the contacting the other replicas. Doesn't that delay things like writes?
So certainly if you have a replicated cluster, it's going to be slower than an unreplicated cluster, partially because of the, or at least for operations that require serialization, there will be some small cost to doing the two-phase commit to the other replicas. But actually, that only happens even when you're first extending the blob, which is getting sort of this allocation of track numbers. But applications are free to extend by as many tracks as they want. For example, if you have an application that knows it's about to write 1,000 tracks, it can do a single extend blob for 1,000 tracks and then write into that big range that it's allocated for itself. Whereas if you don't know, then you can just do smaller allocations. And the actual physical space on the disks is allocated lazily. So if you allocate a large number of tracks and then end up not using it, it doesn't actually cost you any disk space.
Preston Crowe, EMC Corporation. When you talked about your system scaling out to, say, 1,000 disks, that's on the same order of magnitude as the commercial high-end storage systems from EMC, Hitachi, and others. I was wondering if you've compared how your system performs versus the commercial products, and if you have any thoughts as how it might scale to orders of magnitude larger.
Yeah, so unfortunately, just because of the financial constraint that we only had a certain size cluster, we couldn't do a direct one-to-one comparison with something of a data center scale. But part of what we really like about the design is that we're really confident that it scales even up to larger numbers. And there are a couple of reasons for that. One is that at the scale of the network that we built, it's possible to go out and buy one of these big Arista switches that gives you full bisection bandwidth guaranteed, just by one big switch at the top. We intentionally didn't use that, but because we wanted to show that the performance still works even in the presence of one of these highly distributed class networks where you did not have performance guarantees. So the particular numbers for our machine were for about 1,000 machines, but the class network, that two-layer class network with 64 ports per switch, scales out to something like 75 or 80,000 servers. And the metadata, again, we have a few designs for reducing the size of the track locator table, just so it's not too physically big, so that it fits in memory, for example. And everything else, as we've seen, has just been strikingly linear. So I'm very confident that it does scale up to tens of thousands of nodes. We've certainly seen linear scaling so far, but I don't actually have an experiment that shows, let's say, a 70,000 node cluster yet.
Thank you.
Hong Tan from Arduino.com. So very interesting talk. One of the things I can see, it's different from GFS or Hadoop, is that you have a separate storage and a computation. While, but in many of the applications, you don't see the kind of pattern like sort where, you know, the output and the input is exactly the same amount. You typically see, you know, map phase generated 5 to 1 from 5x input to only one copy of the output. So I'm really curious. So what's the motivation behind separating storage and computation, and also how does it compare in terms of the cost-wise?
Oh, sure. So so our motivation for separating them is that it makes the computational model much simpler. So today, there are a lot of clusters built that you really can only extract full performance out of if you express your program as data parallel in a way that you can ship the computation to the storage. So that has certainly been very successful for a large number of applications, but there are also a large number of applications that break down in that case. So sort is the classic example. The reason that was defined as a benchmark is because it sort of stands in place as an IO torture test for computations for which there is no locality. So what we were trying to do is build a cluster which had no constraints a priori on the pattern of computation to storage. So that you could, for example, be confident that even if your application grew beyond a rack where you no longer had the full bisection bandwidth network, that the performance would essentially more or less be the same regardless of scale. That you could grow all the way up to the size of the entire cluster or all the way down to the size of the rack. The performance would remain the same, and programmers also have the freedom to express their program really in whatever programming model most suits the problem, even if it's not a data parallel model.
Just one minor follow-up. So do you plan to have a new programming model, or is purely working with conventional applications?
Okay, I'm being told that there's a big hook that's pulling me off stage, so okay. Let's take this offline. Thanks.
Sure. Thanks, Jeremy.